Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. 50 years ago this month, this nation faced a crisis that some believe could well have plunged the world into nuclear war. The Cuban and Soviet governments had secretly developed nuclear missile bases in Cuba, ultimately leading to a diplomatic showdown between the U.S. and the Soviet Union that could have escalated militarily. After a naval blockade and a lot of tense behind-the-scenes diplomacy, the two sides ultimately came to a mutually agreeable, though private, solution that involved the dismantling of the bases in Cuba in return for the eventual removal of U.S. missiles in Turkey. The Cuban Missile Crisis was arguably the most tense two-week period of the Cold War. Exhaustive analysis has been done, books have been written, movies made, all examining precisely how the events of October 1962 played out. We have the published accounts of many key players, including Attorney General Robert Kennedy, the brother of the president, whose account was published after his death in the book 13 Days. We have the recollections of then-Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who shared his candid memories in the 2003 Errol Morris documentary, The Fog of War. And we have accounts from other members of what came to be known as XCOM, the executive committee, which navigated a way to the peaceful removal of Soviet missiles in Cuba. And yet, there are discrepancies between their accounts and audio recordings that were only declassified in recent years. Today on Focus, we look back at the Cuban Missile Crisis and examine the almost mythological narrative that has been woven about how the Kennedy White House and the military alternately worked together and, at times, battled one another as they sought to address the Cuban and Soviet governments' development of nuclear missile bases in Cuba. We'll discuss where the myth may not necessarily mesh with the facts and what lessons, if any, can be learned from what we know about how the Cuban Missile Crisis played out in the Kennedy White House. We have two guests with us. Timothy McCune is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He has written and lectured for many years about the Cuban Missile Crisis, debunking some conventional wisdom about it and exploring the lessons that can be learned from it. Dr. McCune, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And Dr. Sheldon Stern is also with us today. He served as historian at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston from 1977 to 2000. He's written extensively on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and his latest book is entitled The Cuban Missile Crisis in American History, Myths versus Reality. Dr. Stern, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
And we welcome you to the conversation as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Professor McCune, to understand the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think perhaps we should start with some of the events that led to it. Why did the Soviets feel compelled to work with Fidel Castro in Cuba to establish missile bases 90 miles from the U.S.?
I think it probably would be best to start with the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. That was an attempt that was sponsored by the U.S. government to have a group of Cuban exiles land on Cuba and hopefully foment a rebellion within the Cuban armed forces that would lead to the fall of Fidel Castro. That effort was a failure. The invasion ended after a few short days, and the invading force was either killed or captured. After that happened, both the Cuban government and the Soviets concluded that this was not the end of American attempts to overthrow Castro, that there would be another attempt, that it would be more serious, and that it would be more likely to succeed. And that led them to begin to talk about ways that they could either deter or defeat a second invasion attempt. In addition to that, by late 1961, the United States not only had discovered that the Soviet Union did not have a lead in intercontinental ballistic missiles, it had let the Soviet Union know that it knew that the Soviets did not have a lead. So Khrushchev became concerned at that point about the Soviet strategic position, and one of the other factors that led to his decision to install ballistic missiles in Cuba was a desire to counterbalance American nuclear strategic forces.
In fact, Dr. Stern, we can't really talk, I guess, about Soviet missiles in Cuba without talking about American missiles in Turkey.
Well, that's absolutely true. Although, getting to Khrushchev's motives, of course, are very complicated. But without question, he himself said that sitting on the beach across from the Turkish coast and the Black Sea, near the Black Sea and near the old Tsarist palace, he looked across the Black Sea and he realized that there were these missiles there and that he was going to. He said, "You know, I'm going to teach them a lesson, give them a taste of their own medicine." That's clearly part of the story, but the only other thing that I thought is very important to note that Tim didn't mention is, of course, the after the failure of the Bay of Pigs, the administration then began with the Operation Mongoose and other similar programs to destabilize the Cuban regime through burning crops and various other kinds of sabotage and essentially terrorism, you can call it that. And of course, in addition, efforts to get rid of Castro himself, to kill Castro. So this was a secret to the American people, but it was not a secret to the people, to the governments of Cuba, the Soviet Union.
So that's sort of the backdrop of what was happening at the time leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Dr. McCune, it seems to me like there are perhaps three distinct narratives surrounding the Cuban Missile Crisis. One, how Americans perceived it playing out as it was happening. And, of course, there's a lot they did not know at the time.
Right.
Two, how it was described in Bobby Kennedy's 13 Days, what has largely become the sort of national mythology surrounding it. And then three, what we have learned in recent years as more information about it, including audio recordings of the XCOM meetings themselves, have become declassified. Let's start with the first narrative. As far as the general public was concerned, what exactly happened in October of 62?
Well, I think people had been concerned about Cuba before that time. It was an issue that was in the news a lot. There were a lot of public opinion polls that asked people's opinions about Cuba. So it wasn't a complete surprise when President Kennedy went on the air on October 22nd and gave a speech where he announced the Soviet missiles in Cuba and denounced them as a serious threat to the United States. I think people instantly understood that this was a very serious situation and a very threatening situation. I know I watched the speech at the time. I was 11 years old, and I understood it to be very serious. My parents understood it to be very serious. I think most people did.
Dr. Stern, what then did we learn through Bobby Kennedy's accounts and similar recollections from other members of XCOM in the years that followed about how everything played out?
Well, that, of course, is the ultimate question. Robert Kennedy's account, which he began working on very soon after the crisis, throughout 1963, and which, of course, was not published. It was completed after his death by Ted Sorensen and was published in 1969. It has never been out of print in the 43 years since. And Bobby Kennedy's take on what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and especially, of course, as his own first-person account of the XCOM meetings, has become the narrative, and you use the term the mythological narrative, which I was delighted to hear, because that's exactly what it is. I think we now understand, as a result of the opening of the tapes, that that 13 days is extremely misleading and inaccurate, and was essentially really written the way it was written to promote Robert Kennedy's own political ambitions. Initially, it was intended to be used in the 1964 JFK's reelection campaign, but once that was no longer relevant, then RFK essentially changed the theme of the book. And there's an extraordinary story that really demonstrates that when in the spring of 64, about 6 months after JFK's death, Robert Kennedy gave Kenny O'Donnell, one of his brother's closest associates, a copy of the manuscript to read, and when he came to pick it up, Kenny O'Donnell said, "I thought your brother was president during the missile crisis." And Bobby is said to have replied, "He's not running and I am," because he was running for a Senate seat in New York in 64, which he won. So that gives us a bit of a hint.
I want to expound on that hint in just a second, but a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are looking back at the Cuban Missile Crisis on today's show. It happened 50 years ago this month. We're discussing, as we just said, the almost mythological narrative that has been woven about how the Kennedy White House and the military alternately worked together and then at times sort of battled one another as they sought to address the Cuban and Soviet government's development of nuclear missile bases in Cuba. Helping us to navigate where the myth ends and the facts begin are two historians who have devoted much of their lives to examining the subject. Timothy McCune is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Sheldon Stern served as historian at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston from 1977 to 2000. His latest book is The Cuban Missile Crisis in American History.
Memory.
Oh, excuse me, Memory. Memory, Myths versus Reality. We welcome your questions and comments for you can see just how easy it is to turn the myth into the history. My apologies.
That's no problem. Don't worry about it.
We welcome your questions and comments for Drs. McCune and Stern at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, we've teased this out long enough. Dr. Stern, what is the difference between Bobby Kennedy's account, the what we've characterized as an almost mythological account of what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and what in recent years declassified audio tapes have sort of indicated actually may have occurred?
Well, the key to the whole thing is that on that final evening, a secret deal was made that Tim already met, Professor McCune already mentioned about the swap of the Turkish missiles for the removal of the missiles in Cuba. But it really can only be understood in the context of the two letters. Khrushchev sent a private letter through diplomatic channels on Friday evening, the 26th, which once you get through all the bombast and all the rhetoric, he basically said, we will take the missiles out of Cuba if you make a public pledge not to invade Cuba. That message was received Friday evening after the XCOM had broken up, and the next time they met was the following morning, Saturday morning, the 27th, and that's what they began to talk about. But within a very short time, Press Secretary P.S. Salinger comes in, and it becomes clear that Khrushchev has made a second offer. But this offer hasn't come through diplomatic channels. It's not private. This one was made publicly on Moscow radio. And there's a lot of confusion in the room initially until they eventually sort out the fact that this is indeed a new offer. It's not the same as last night's offer. And it has clearly changed the narrative. He's asking for something that he didn't ask for last night. And from that moment on Saturday morning, the room basically, for the next 12 hours, divides into two sides. One side insisting that Khrushchev's offer had to be accepted and the missiles had to be removed from Cuba, from Turkey. The other side saying that that would be a terrible mistake that would undermine our credibility in Berlin. It would undermine our credibility with NATO. It would look like a cave-in. We would appear to be weak, etc., etc. And the key problem with 13 days is that Robert Kennedy doesn't tell the truth about who was on what side and exactly how that debate transpired. And the fact is, it's a bit oversimplified, but it is certainly true, that basically the room divided into two sides. One side was President Kennedy, and the other side was everybody else. Everybody. Without exception, Robert Kennedy, McNamara, Bundy, Rusk, Ambassador Thompson, et cetera, were all opposed vigorously and persistently throughout the whole day, opposed to accepting this deal. But in the end, the deal was proposed because, in the end, it's the president's decision, not the decision of XCOM.
Professor McCune, my recollection through popular culture, through Robert Kennedy's book, 13 Days, through the film adaptation of that about 10 years or so ago, and there have been others, suggest that the division wasn't between President Kennedy and everyone else, but it was between the Kennedy administration, basically any of the folks within his administration that were civilians, and then the military. And that's sort of the narrative that became woven, that the military was pushing for military action, and that everyone within the White House itself, within the administration, was trying to come up with an alternative solution.
I think that's partially true. I think certainly if you look at what the Joint Chiefs of Staff were saying among themselves and saying to the president as well, it was clear that they wanted an airstrike and an invasion. They did not want a limited surgical strike on the missiles. They were concerned that a limited use of force would just be a sop or a substitute for what they viewed as what was necessary to solve the problem. Where that view is too limited is that it really doesn't discuss the fact that, as Sheldon said, there was a great deal of sentiment among the civilians in the XCOM for using force as well, and that in that sense it wasn't just simply the military versus the civilians, that
there were
a lot of civilians who at one point or another expressed a desire to use force. In fact, it's probably accurate to say that everyone on the XCOM, including the president, at one point or another thought that an airstrike or an invasion might be necessary.
Yes, at the beginning, at the very beginning, after the first day, or into the evening of the first day, everyone seemed to feel, including President Kennedy, that there was some sort of military action, probably taking out the missile sites with airstrikes, was necessary. But that began to change over the subsequent days.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are historian Sheldon Stern, author of the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis in American Memory, and Timothy McCune, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're discussing the Cuban Missile Crisis, which occurred 50 years ago this month. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages as well. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let me throw this question out to both of you, and I guess it's the sort of question that historians will receive a lot, which is, why should we care who was on what side internally in the White House, in XCOM, during the Cuban Missile Crisis? Why does it matter? Let me start with Dr. Stern.
Why does it matter? Well, I mean, if you're a historian, it matters a great deal, because it's our job to figure out what happened. And above all, when we're dealing with a situation like this, where nuclear war, thermonuclear war, which would essentially have been the end of human civilization as we know it, was a distinct possibility, as Michael Dobbs's recent book, 2008, showed. There was several moments during the crisis when, I mean, events were occurring that could not be controlled by Kennedy or by Khrushchev or by anybody else. There was a great deal of luck involved as well, and it makes an enormous difference in understanding the mindset of people like McNamara and Bundy and Rusk, certainly, when you look down the road at what, for example, happened in Vietnam in 65 and after. I mean, that's what historians do. It makes an enormous difference. We also, for example, I can add a point, Vice President Johnson was excluded from the smaller meeting on Saturday evening, the 27th, in the Oval Office, at which the final decision was hammered out to go with the compromise, or to offer Ambassador Dobrynin the compromise. And the people who were in that smaller meeting, it was about half the XCOM, pledged to absolute secrecy that they would never reveal that this secret offer had been made. And they kept their word, but incredibly, they kept their word after Johnson became president a year later. Hmm. And he was never told. And as historian Max Holland has demonstrated, there were at least several occasions on the Johnson tapes when LBJ would say something like, well, you know, Jack Kennedy faced down the Soviets in the fall of 1962. He was tough, and they backed down. it might have been interesting and important for Johnson to know that that's not what happened. What happened was that Kennedy cut a deal that he compromised to avoid nuclear war. Maybe if Johnson had known that, maybe he wouldn't have felt so much pressure to nail the coonskin to the wall, as he said about Vietnam. Who knows? That's speculation.
Professor McCune, do you think there are lessons to be learned, if not for subsequent presidents, but maybe for the public at large, about historical narratives and mythologies that this instance demonstrates?
Yeah, I really do. I think one of the reasons why the XCOM tapes are fascinating is because they provide this really wonderful glimpse into how a presidential advisory system works and the kind of advice that John F. Kennedy was getting. They also are very revealing in terms of how a president reacts to advice. And one of the lessons from the tapes that I think is relevant to the current era and will always be relevant in thinking about U.S. foreign policy is, what kind of stakes or what kind of interests do the president's advisors think are important? What kinds of advice do they give to the president? And when does a president listen to his advisors, and when does he have the good sense to set what they say aside and elect an independent course of action? Presidents are not just the creature of their advisors. They're often talked about as if they are. That was certainly not the case for John Kennedy, and it was certainly not the case for some other Cold War presidents that we had as well. And I think understanding the possibilities and also the limitations of the presidential advisory system is something that's very helpful in terms of thinking about what we can expect from our current presidents.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests this morning are Timothy McCune, Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Sheldon Stern, a historian and author of the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis in American Memory. Well, I'm getting the title of your book wrong. I'm getting your name wrong. I do apologize for that.
Don't worry about it.
We welcome your questions and comments this morning, and I hope I get the phone number right, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number is again 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and we'll go first this morning to Ann in Effingham. Good morning, Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to respond to some of this. First of all, I was an adult at this time, a teacher and the mother of two small children, so I was more than aware of what was going on and more focused upon it than many. First of all, I didn't think the deal with Turkey was kept secret very long. Surely within the year or two, I knew of it. It seems to me the point there is that those weapons we took from Turkey were obsolete, so that we didn't suffer any great loss. Secondly, I would suggest that the president was one of the very few at the table, perhaps the only one, who had endured surface combat and really understood war. And three, as I understand it, the Joint Chiefs were unaware that the Russians had nuclear weapons in Cuba. It wasn't just posturing. And had we followed Curtis LeMay's advice and gone in gung-ho with air power, we might well have put Miami and other cities in the U.S. at risk, because the Russian military was really ticked off at Khrushchev for suggesting the secret deal. So right. I'd like to hear the response to that.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. And gentlemen, as you respond, I also want to point out an email from Wes, who also wanted to ask if you would talk a little bit about Curtis LeMay's role and influence with regard to others in the military and with regards to the president's decision.
Well, let me. There were three parts to the question, so I'm not sure I remember all three at this point. But the first thing about the caller said that she knew about the deal. Well, if she did, then she was had privileged information, because the deal was not revealed until Dean Rusk and Ted Sorensen owned up to it at the Moscow conference in 1989. There were rumors, of course, but it was never acknowledged. It was never officially recognized as having happened. Now, as far as the third part, let me just finish. Well, the third part, I don't remember the middle part. The third part about the Joint Chiefs, of course the Joint Chiefs knew they had nuclear weapons, but they believed that the blockade was extremely dangerous, and the Soviets would fire the weapons in response to the blockade. Fortunately, they were wrong.
Professor McCune?
I think the caller is probably right in her recollection of remembering the missiles being withdrawn from Turkey. The withdrawal was public.
Yes, of course.
And
but
I
not
think
the fact that it had been part of a deal in
right.
October.
Well, I think there was probably speculation about linkage that might have appeared in some places, but there was certainly never any official knowledge or official acknowledgement of
correct.
That. And that, I think, is the critical point. One of the caller's other points was about the fact that John Kennedy had seen combat in World War II. He certainly did, and his boat was sunk. I'm not sure he was the only one.
Well, of course, General Taylor had certainly seen combat. He was involved in the Sicily invasion.
Right, but he wasn't involved on the front lines in the same way that John Kennedy was. And I don't remember the others well enough. But I think it's widely speculated that Kennedy's attitude towards the Joint Chiefs was partly a reflection of his service experience and his combat experience. He had what a lot of people regard as a healthy skepticism about the views of top brass, and he was certainly skeptical about the Joint Chiefs after the Bay of Pigs. So I think that that was an ingredient in his thinking, and it probably contributed to his self-confidence in going against the advice of the Joint Chiefs on a number of occasions.
Professor, go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and Tim is absolutely right. But it's also important to remember that he got equally militant advice from leaders of Congress, and other sources as well, not to mention, of course, most of the people on the XCOM. So it was almost unanimous between the congressional leadership, the great majority of the members of XCOM, the Joint Chiefs. Everybody wanted a military response.
Is there more to say about Curtis LeMay's role specifically?
Well, I mean, LeMay, it's very easy to parody LeMay, but the fact is that he did take an extremely hard line, and the exchange on October 19th between Kennedy and LeMay is one of the classic moments on the tapes. For example, particularly LeMay accuses JFK of basically of cowardice. He says this blockade is almost as bad as the appeasement at Munich. I remember the first time I heard that tape, I couldn't believe, A, that he said it, and B, that Kennedy didn't respond in some way. But he didn't. He remained very, very calm, and he didn't respond. And for the listeners who don't know, what LeMay was really saying there was, you're a coward, just like your father. Yeah. Because Kennedy's father, when he was ambassador to England in 1938 to 40, was very much involved in Chamberlain's effort to appease Hitler and supported appeasement. And basically, LeMay was saying, you're an appeaser too. So it was an amazing thing to say to the president, but he did not react in any hostile way. He just went on with the conversation. Hmm. But LeMay was LeMay.
Go ahead, Professor.
I was just going to add one comment about the nuclear weapons in Cuba. Mm-hmm. I think there's still some confusion out there about that because there were actually several different Soviet weapon systems in Cuba, and the ballistic missiles were not the only missiles that had nuclear warheads.
Correct.
And the U.S. was not really aware of the nuclear warheads for the non-ballistic missile systems until late in the crisis. The initial invasion plans envisioned U.S. invasion forces fighting a conventional war. Late in the crisis, when it became apparent that the Soviets might have nuclear warheads on their tactical weapons, the invasion plans began to be altered to include the use of nuclear weapons. But that was not immediately apparent at the outset of the crisis.
No, and it was not revealed until just a few years ago that two of those nuclear cruise missiles had been moved into position to obliterate the Guantanamo naval base in the event of an American attack. And it's pretty scary to think of what the reaction to that would almost certainly have been.
We're looking back at the Cuban Missile Crisis on today's show. It happened 50 years ago this month. We're discussing the almost mythological narrative that has been woven about how the Kennedy White House and the military worked to address the Cuban and Soviet government's development of nuclear missile bases in Cuba. Helping us to navigate where the myth ends and the facts begin are two historians. They've devoted much of their lives to examining the subject. Timothy McCune, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Sheldon Stern, who served as historian at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston from 1977 to 2000. His latest book is The Cuban Missile Crisis in American Memory, Myths versus Reality. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take more of your phone calls and emails for Drs. McCune and Stern after a short break. This is Focus.
News, public affairs, local programming, classical music. WILL's AM and FM stations are a community resource worth supporting. There's still time for you to help triple the value of supporter pledges during our two-for-one donation deals during our fall pledge drive next week. Now's the time. Give online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
WILL programming is made possible by Sangamon Auditorium, University of Illinois, Springfield. Presenting Savion Glover, demonstrating his reverence for the art and legends of tap dance in Soul Sanctuary, this Sunday, October 14th at 7. Information at sangamonauditorium.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Today we're looking back at the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took place 50 years ago this month. Our guests, historian Sheldon Stern, author of the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis in American Memory, and Timothy McCune, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Gary in Tolono. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, gentlemen. Did the people pushing for a military action think that they could contain a nuclear war? Because a tactical strike would soon escalate into a strategic strike. And I'll list off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, I think that the caller put his finger on the issue. That was exactly what President Kennedy was saying all along, that we can't use nuclear weapons, because once you use a nuclear weapon, inevitably the other side will use a nuclear weapon, and on it goes up the scale, and then becomes impossible to control. As a matter of fact, the day after Khrushchev's decision to withdraw the missiles on Sunday the 28th, on Monday morning the 29th, the president met in the Oval Office with two of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Anderson, the Chief of Naval Operations, and General Shoup, the Marine Corps Commandant, and they talked about the use of nuclear weapons. And Kennedy says very specifically, well, of course, these are not really weapons, because we can't use them. Hmm. That their purpose is not military, it's psychological and political, but we can't use them. Nobody can use nuclear weapons, because it'll get out of control. It's exactly what he says.
Go ahead, Professor McCune.
I think that understanding was more general within the XCOM. Whenever they talked about an airstrike against the missile sites, there were always two obstacles to doing an airstrike that the XCOM kept coming back to over and over and over again. The first was that the military couldn't guarantee that if there were air attacks on the ballistic missiles, that they would succeed in destroying them all. And secondly, they couldn't guarantee that if there were surviving missiles, they wouldn't be launched.
Precisely.
And the general recognition of both of those possibilities is probably why there were never airstrikes at all, because there certainly was a lot of sentiment for airstrikes at various points during that two-week period. There were certainly a lot of people who thought that sooner or later they'd have to be resorted to. But whenever it really came down to a question of authorizing them, those two barriers always got in the way.
Do you sense that XCOM sort of set a style, an approach to addressing foreign policy issues that subsequent presidents and administrations have used, where they say, okay, let's walk through, if we do this, what happens next? And then if they do that, what happens next? And this sort of back and forth consideration of how things could escalate so that you don't make a decision early on that almost inevitably leads to something much worse down the road. Is that something that, a lot of presidents have taken into account and have taken maybe from this experience?
In a word, no.
Okay.
I don't really think that you can survey the experience of most major foreign policy decisions since then, at least the ones we know about and have declassification on. We can't survey those and see the same kind of thoroughgoing, wide-ranging, intense debate that we see over this 13-day period. That doesn't happen with regard to Vietnam decisions. It seems not to have happened with regard to the decisions pertaining to both of our wars against Iraq. And I don't know about the minor decisions, such as the intervention in Grenada, et cetera, but I suspect that there was not that kind of in-depth consideration at that time either.
If the answer is no, then why not? Why is this not a lesson that has not been learned?
I think partly because the stakes at the time were so high and everyone knew it. Everyone understood that there was a real possibility that general nuclear war could result from the wrong choices. And that made everyone extraordinarily careful about the decision, and it made them quite devoted to working through the consequences of the decision as best they could. That's generally not true on most other foreign policy decisions.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Mike in Urbana. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, I'd like to say I'm very grateful that they didn't decimate the naval base, because I was there.
I am too.
Yes,
it's good to be here.
Glad to have you.
I was an intelligence assistant in the Marine Corps intelligence assistant, and I got there December of '61, and I was there for 19 months. As far as the timing of this, there are a couple things that don't quite square with what I hear about the fact that when the president and his advisors first learned about the missiles, that it took them 4 days. In 4 days, they had everything in motion. There were two things that would seem to contradict that. One, seems like they would have known about it sooner, because number one, and this could be purely coincidental, on Gitmo, every 6 weeks we had a command post exercise. It always started at 8:30 on Saturday morning. It secured it 24 hours later. That happened to be the weekend, and of course we didn't secure. We could just, you know, we were 8:30 came, and 9 and 10, and finally somebody screamed attention, and in walks a general who had never. We didn't have a general on the base till then. So that could be purely coincidental. But here's something else. Of course, all of the civilians and non-combat personnel had to be evacuated.
Right.
And there were two ships. I think they were MSTS. I don't know what that stands for. But they made a bi-monthly trip between Brooklyn and Trinidad. And they could only do it. 1 month, one of them would dock to transfer personnel, and another month, another one. So it took a while to make this trip. I know, I came back. When I was transferred back, it took me 6 days to get from Gitmo to Brooklyn. Well, it just so happens that very weekend, that both of those ships were docked at Gitmo, and that I don't think they could have discharged all their passengers and got both of those ships to Gitmo in 4 days. Now, I might be wrong. One other thing, too, that I remember before all this happened, one day there was a man from the shop, I should say CIA, came down. He was in our office. Even though I had a top-secret clearance, I wasn't privy to what he was there for, so I have no idea. But that was before this happened. So I would question whether the administration didn't know about this until that beginning of that four-day period, or they must have known about it several days or maybe weeks before. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a tremendous controversy about that. There's a new book, a very important book about that, Blind Over Cuba by Max Holland, about the intelligence failures and cancellations. It's a very, very important book. And there were many reports in Washington before October 14th claiming that there were missiles. They were repeatedly denied by the people in the administration whose job it was to look into this. And it certainly was a great surprise when the pictures were taken on the 14th. We now know certain things about where those reports were coming from, as to why they were not taken more seriously in Washington. I mean, I don't have an answer. But the fact is that was a significant problem during some of the XCOM meetings. Robert Kennedy in particular was very concerned about people saying they were closing the barn door after the horses escaped. You know, why didn't we know about this sooner? And there were all kinds of discussions about how to handle that public relations issue.
As an intelligence officer, you probably can appreciate that there were a lot of refugees leaving Cuba at that time. And the CIA began to interview these refugees systematically. And it also interviewed, of course, other people leaving Cuba, and it had its own agent network on the island. That accumulation of human intelligence over a period of months began to gradually yield more and more information about the possibility of something major like ballistic missiles being on Cuba. Dino Brugioni in his book mentions that by the fall of 1962, they had something like 1,000 human reports that made some mention of missiles in Cuba. Now, of course, many of those reports were erroneous or fanciful, and many of the ones that were talking about missiles didn't distinguish between the intermediate-range ballistic missiles that were the center of the crisis and the surface-to-air missiles that everyone knew were being installed.
Right. Purely defensive missiles.
Right. So it was hard to separate the wheat from the chaff or the signal from the noise from the standpoint of the intelligence officers. But we do know that beginning in August and September, there was considerably more discussion of and attention to the possibility of ballistic missiles being installed in Cuba. We also know that in August and September, there was a big stepping up of the military planning effort for airstrikes or invasion against Cuba. We also know that in the second weekend of September, the State Department was requested to prepare a legal opinion on the legality of a blockade of Cuba, and this was well over a month before the XCOM met to make such a decision. So your hunch that people were not completely taken by surprise in mid-October is, I think, correct. But I think the evidence that they had before they got to the U-2 photographs was far more ephemeral and far more ambiguous and didn't really permit decisive action in the way the photographs did.
Right. I agree with everything Tim said, and I would add that on that Sunday morning, McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, went on a television program, Meet the Press or something like that, and was asked about it, and he said no, he didn't think the Russians would put missiles in Cuba. That would be extremely dangerous, and he didn't think they would do anything so provocative. And, of course, it was that evening that he found out that, indeed, it had happened.
Getting back to the audio recordings that were declassified, Dr. Stern, despite the fact that we have those recordings, these myths do kind of remain about, in particular, Robert Kennedy's role and attitudes. I'm curious if there are other examples that come to mind for you of enduring American history myths that we've sort of long since debunked, have you know, pretty clear evidence to support, well, that's not really how it happened, but we've all just sort of decided, nah, we're gonna say that's how it happened.
These things happen all the time. You know, there were a very long time there was a myth that Lincoln had written the Gettysburg Address on the train from Washington to Pennsylvania, just jotted it on the back of an envelope. You still see it occasionally, and of course it's not true. I'm trying to think of any others.
There's some really, you know, the outlandish ones are like, you know, Washington chopping down the cherry tree and that kind of thing.
I'm not even going to get into anything like that. But I mean, for example, Woodrow Wilson on the night before he went to Congress to ask for a declaration of war against Germany, he is supposed to have met in the Oval Office with an old friend, a journalist, I believe he was, and according to the journalist, Wilson broke down and wept over the fact that he was going to have to ask for a declaration of war, and that this would be a terrible thing, and it would transform the American people, and we would, you know, threaten some of our basic rights because of the hysteria of war and all the rest of that. And recently it was demonstrated that such a meeting never took place, that the man was not even in Washington at the time.
You know, one of the most interesting things about the Cuban Missile Crisis and our collective recollections of it really comes down to the fact that we have both first-person accounts and now we have these audio recordings, and they don't match up.
That's the most important thing.
Dr. Stern, in your book, you write about first-person accounts, and you suggest, and this is how you write it, you say, the claim that I was there should, if anything, be regarded as a warning about historical inaccuracy rather than accepted as a special form of validation. We do hear that phrase all the time in all kinds of contexts. In fact, most recently in the vice presidential debate, Vice President Biden used those words in reference to his being present when President Reagan, House Speaker Tip O'Neill, and others worked in a bipartisan fashion on tax policy in the 80s. First-person accounts are key to our understanding of history. Why do you think we should see someone's statement that I was there might be a warning that what they might say might not be entirely accurate?
Well, I think it's just basic common sense that people write memoirs about events in which they were involved with a certain agenda. And this is absolutely true in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis. McNamara's recollections are wrong. Thompson's recollections are wrong. Bundy's recollections are wrong. And needless to say, RFK's are wrong. They're all contradicted by the tapes. It's an extraordinary phenomenon, and I have experienced it personally on several occasions, and I'm just saying that one has to be extremely cautious about accepting first-person accounts when there's no verification. Mm.
Professor McCune, we have just a minute or two left. What ultimately are the lessons we should learn from the Cuban Missile Crisis and how it's remembered, or as the case may be, misremembered?
Well, I think one of the real cautionary lessons from the crisis is how casually high officials sometimes come to conclusions about what to do on the basis of their own subjective reading of the case and a very, very limited understanding of what's going on. When I think about the number of people who blithely said, oh, we should just invade, without any real appreciation of what might be involved in invading Cuba, I think it's a very good caution about the ease with which particularly the use of force can be embarked upon without a real appreciation of what it can lead to.
Dr. Stern?
Well, you know, maybe the thing that I would like to conclude with is just this morning the Kennedy Library opened about 60 boxes of Robert Kennedy's papers for the first time to the public. They're now online, and I was going through some of them this morning, and one of the first things I picked out was a note. It's in the October 16th box, but it can't be from October 16th. It's clearly from October 27th because it says night meeting 9 p.m., and the only meeting at 9 p.m. was on Saturday the 27th, and also it fits in terms of its context, and it's in Robert Kennedy's handwriting, and he says, President, no sense in going in against only anti-aircraft. If we go in, we go in hard. Call up plane reserves today. Call up ship reserves tomorrow. So once again, that's the real Robert Kennedy at these meetings. Mm.
Dr. Sheldon Stern served as historian at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston from 1977 to the year 2000. He's written extensively on the Cuban Missile Crisis. His latest book is The Cuban Missile Crisis in American Memory, Myths versus Reality. Dr. Stern, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
And Timothy McCune is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He has written and lectured for many years about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Dr. McCune, we want to thank you for being with us today as well.
You're quite welcome.
My thanks also to Rob Holliday and Dylan Field at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Department of News Services for providing that great in-studio connection with Dr. McCune today. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Remember, you can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. I have two shows to tell you about that are coming up on Monday. First, in our usual time slot at 10 a.m., we will talk with NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about his life and career in journalism, about hosting Morning Edition, and about his new book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Should be a fascinating conversation, and we'll give you an opportunity to call in and talk with Steve about whatever's on your mind related to the work he does at NPR, as well as the subject matter of his book. We'll also have a special opportunity for you to receive a copy of his book and support WILL as we begin our fall fundraising campaign. But oh, that's not all. Monday night at 9 here on WILL AM 580 and on WILL TV, I will welcome your questions and comments for University of Illinois President Robert Easter. He will join us in the WILL TV studio to field your questions, anything you may want to know about the future of the University of Illinois. In fact, if you would like to send us your questions now, we will welcome them at will-talk@illinois.edu. Then I hope you'll tune in. Again, that's President Easter on a special edition of Focus Monday night at 9, simulcast on WILL TV and WILL AM 580. Today's show is produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.